Cascadia. Today is Thursday, March 18th, 2010. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM. KBOO.fm on the web. And this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
Monday is World Water Day. Do you know where your water goes once it leaves your drain?
Drought is officially declared for Klamath County, so I guess your water didn't go there.
And the Wachovia Bank learns the hard way that drugs will get you through times without money better than money will get you through times without drugs.
Portland area weather today, fabulous. Sunny with a high near 62. Tonight, clear, low around 34. And then beautiful through Saturday, highs in the 60s and lows in the 40s.
Well, first we go to regional news from around Cascadia with this good bit of information. Celebrate gray water reuse in Oregon on World Water Day. Recode Oregon is reveling in their recent victory, and they want to share the celebration with the rest of Portland. They fought hard and long to allow Portlanders to reuse water from household appliances in gardens and growing areas. My guest today is Brenna Bell with Tryon Life Farms, joining us to tell us more about the celebration that Recode is launching. Good morning, Brenna. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Well, you first off, tell listeners a little bit about the long road to where we are now as far as gray water use is concerned.
Sure, and some of your listeners might remember, we were talking last year about making a bill passed through the state legislature to legalize the reuse of gray water, that's water from our sinks, from our baths, showers, for irrigation purposes outdoor, which was basically prohibited by DEQ's rules. So we were successful in that, and in last May, Governor Kulongowski signed a bill, and we never really celebrated it. We've continued down the road because, you know, in some ways we're in the hardest part right now, which is rule writing, which is writing the actual specifics of how these will be used. And so we decided, being that World Water Day was coming up, to celebrate the victory that we had and also to keep it in the public eye that we're not done.
Brenna, let me ask you one question. Why is it so important that our sources of water and the way that we choose to use water, is it's important to keep that decentralized and in the hands of the actual users?
Well, I think there's several reasons. I mean, one, we are approaching a time where water is becoming more and more scarce. So we need to learn how to use our water more wisely. And currently, we're sending hundreds of thousands of gallons of very high-quality, reusable water down into the municipal sewer system where it causes all sorts of problems. And so what gray water does is redirect that so people can use it to irrigate rather than using fresh potable water to irrigate when it's not necessary that it's that high quality of water. It also closes a lot of loops or cycles that are broken when we send away perfectly good water and import, you know, high quality water that we should be saving and conserving for drinking.
Thanks so much. The irony, of course, is that as potable water becomes more and more scarce, its value goes up, and Wall Street takes note of that and makes moves towards privatizing water sources, and yet at the same time, water held in private hands is in many ways safer from privatization. Can you, just before we let you go here, tell listeners about the celebration, when, where, and all that?
Sure. It's on March 22nd, that's Monday, from 5:30 to 7:30, and that's at the Sea Change Gallery, which is at 625 North Everett Street. And so we'll be celebrating gray water. We have a debut of our new video about gray water systems. We'll have an update about the rulemaking. Ben Cannon, who is one of the Bill's champions, will be there. And we'll also be doing two other things, giving a sneak preview of our next campaign, which is around ecological sanitation and how to keep your poop on site and compost it, which also the state regulations do not like. And this is a benefit for our upcoming statewide networking tour, where Recode will be connecting with people all over the state who want to legalize sustainability. And so we really invite people to come, find out about Greywater, find out about things they can be doing right now to help legalize sustainability and support World Water Day. For more information, you can go to our website, which is recodeoregon.net.
Thanks so much for that. My guest has been Brenna Bell with Tran Life Farm. Thanks again, Brenna.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yesterday, the city council got on board with a new curbside food composting pilot project. The test neighborhoods will be named next month, and the project kicks off in May. The 2-gallon pails will take pretty much anything but pizza boxes. The contents can be emptied into the green roll cart now reserved for yard debris. Most garbage rates will not increase, although residents who insist on weekly trash pickup will have to pay double. City officials hope for food composting citywide by spring next year.
That's sort of a version of sheet mulching on a grand scale. Well, it's unanimous. Yesterday, the Portland City Council voted to spend the $20 million in sewer contract savings to help build new bike lanes. Commissioner Amanda Fritz wasn't entirely happy. She wanted another week to study the question. The $20 million will not pay for bike boulevards directly. The money will actually pay for green streets, a stormwater filtering feature that can double with bike lanes. Here in Portland, we already pay some of the highest sewer rates in the country. Some ratepayers have complained the mayor's proposal is an unfair raid on sewer dollars. Like so many issues, though, it comes down to the real cost of wasting water.
Here we are, poised on the edge of World Water Day for a swan dive, or maybe a swan song. It's official, drought in the Klamath Basin. Governor Kulongoski declared a drought emergency in Klamath County and asked the federal government for a disaster determination that would bring more federal aid to farmers and ranchers. This is really one for the Tea Partiers to ponder. The problem is not one the federal government has any part in. It's the individual responsibility of every family and every farm to wake up to the fact that water is our most precious resource. A state drought declaration is far from a cure-all, but it would allow farmers to apply for emergency drought permits to tap groundwater instead of surface waters and to transfer water from one piece of land to another. The solution is scarier than the problem.
Here's a story of a timberland holding company in Portland doing well by doing good, in the words of Tom Lair. EcoTrust Forest has made a deal to sell carbon credits tied to a forest parcel it owns on Washington's Olympic Peninsula. In terms of PR, this is indeed priceless. But wait, there's more. EcoTrust hopes to showcase the sale as an example of how carbon markets would work in this region in a cap-and-trade world. The company plans to log less frequently, more selectively, and to leave greater setbacks along streams and steep slopes than the law requires. The carbon credits, get this, have already been sold to a New York middleman. EcoTrust is indeed doing well. But is it really doing good by selling carbon credits while the trees are still falling? Recall that the Tom Lear lyrics referenced above are from a tune called The Old Dope Peddler.
Take a walk on the wild side with Wachovia. The public image of banking as a conservative, even stodgy world has been rocked in recent years. This latest, a probe of Wachovia began in 2005 when a narcotics dog in Florida, where else, detected cocaine traces in an airplane. Ultimately, at least $110 million in drug profits laundered from Mexico through Wachovia emerged. The bank and the government reached a mutually agreeable compromise in which the total settlement includes forfeiture in that amount, plus a $50 million fine. The agreement means Wachovia and its executives will avoid criminal prosecution. And best of all, Wall Street remains intact. Because if all the drug money pouring through the halls of commerce were halted, commerce as we know it would die.
Just a few headlines from a recent Lund report posting are enough to cause nausea, dizziness, headache, and vomiting. The top 10, the first story leading off is on the top 10 highest paid Oregon health insurance executives. Regents CEO takes a 40% pay cut while Clear One healthcare plan executives saw their salaries soar last year. There's more here. And to lead us through it, we have independent journalist David Rosenfeld joining us. Good morning. David.
Hi, Chris. Good morning.
Well, you've got some stunner of headlines here to sort through. First, talk a little bit about the health insurer's profits, basically.
Yeah, well, yesterday we reported on year-end financial statements for 2009. Even though it's now March, those statements for the end of the year just came in recently and were released by the Oregon Insurance Division. And so as we do every quarter, we look at those. One thing that the annual statements give us are the salaries for insurance executives, who are largely, in Oregon, these are nonprofits, but these forms give us those for the for-profit companies as well. And as you say, said in your intro, executives for Clear One Health Plans, which is a health insurance company largely in eastern Oregon that's not very big, recently sold to Pacific Source, and a lot of those executives and hospitals profited very largely on that. And we had a story about that a few weeks ago on the site. So then also with the financials, insurers, their profits had increased in 2009 32% compared to 2008. And what I found by looking at their financials is that that was largely due to investment gains. And basically, if it wasn't for the investment gains that they had made in the stock market or their financial markets, our health insurance premiums would be going up even more. So thanks to some rallying in the market this year, we were only looking at 15% increases for most people. So that's sort of something to chew on there.
What about the this ODS health plan losing $38 million?
So, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right, I want to get to that too. This ODS, this issue with ODS, this was a definite exclusive that we are reporting at the Lund Report. We found by going to some public meetings, Diane actually found these and requested the documents. Basically, this is a contract for Oregon school districts. Last year was the first year that school districts across the state unified in one purchasing pool, similar to the way all state employees are represented through the Public Employees Benefit Board. They formed the Oregon Educator Benefit Board last year based on a law that passed in, 2007. And ODS and other insurers bid on those contracts, and several of them were awarded. But ODS made some critical miscalculations, it appears, and they are down $38 million on those contracts. Yeah. So that's a big deal for them and for insiders, but it also means that there is money being diverted from the teachers union, from the Oregon Educators Association, in terms of basically a bailout. It's an $18 million loan to ODS to cover those costs. That money goes to support school districts throughout the state. So this also, this has a pretty big repercussion. I expect to see some other reporting on this because it was a big deal when this plan was proposed. It was Governor Klingowski's pretty big signature issue at the time that school districts would save money by pooling their health insurance. And I think the overall state of that system is yet to be seen, but at least in this case, this one insurer has drastically miscalculated how much that would cost.
It's amazing that they could make a mistake like that. Once again, just to clarify, where exactly is the $38 million that they are coming from?
The deficit is what ODS is spending to pay the claims of, school district employees, school teachers and their dependents throughout Oregon, throughout those that they have contracts to cover. It's being, bailed out by, some complicated reinsurance arrangement, $20 million reinsurance type deal, and then this $18 million loan from the OEA Choice Welfare Benefit Trust, it's called, to be repaid by 2012 at 6% interest. So not unlike some bailouts that the banks have.
So much money flowing around in all directions. You think somebody somewhere along the line would get some health care, but I guess we're still waiting for that. Yeah. My guest has been independent journalist David Rosenfeld with thelundreport.org. There's much, much more that you can have a look at for yourselves on that website. And again, I want to thank David very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This has been Eric Cascadia for Thursday, March 18th, 2010. Engineering is Emily Young. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. Chris Andre is the producer. I'm Liam Delta.
You've been hearing news and comment from Air Cascadia on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, KBOO.fm on the web. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thanks so much, members.
Stay tuned now for Flashpoints. Dar Jamail on the forgotten war in Iraq. A priest who works for the poor in Honduras on continuing violence against people who oppose the recent coup. And Catherine Austin Fitz, Community Business.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support, and have a good day.
Flashpoint special correspondent Dar Jamail remembers the new forgotten war in Iraq. Also, a revered priest from El Salvador reports on a recent visit to neighboring Honduras. Actually, he was there visiting for 20 years and leading the anti-coup activists. We're going to talk to him. He's got quite the story to tell. And also, we'll have regular weekly segment that we have with Catherine Austin Fitz, Community Business. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilan Molina. All this straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And we continue our coverage of the war, the forgotten war, the newly forgotten war, as our first guest, Dar Jamail, puts it. Dar Jamail, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks, Dennis. Good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And now you have done extensive coverage of the situation in Iraq, first with your book that documented your unembedded reporting in Iraq, and now you've been writing with your latest book, Dispatches. This is called, actually, The Will to Resist: Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. First book is Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches. And Dar, 7 years... Nobody's talking much about the war. All I seem to hear is the effectiveness of General Petraeus and that this withdrawal, we're like virtually down to a pittance, 50,000 by August.
Well, so they say. First things first, it's amazing to me the type of so-called coverage that's happening with the occupation of Iraq. In fact, if you go to your grocery store and look at the current issue of Newsweek magazine, the cover is a photo of Bush on the aircraft carrier when he announced mission accomplished. And that's basically the lead story in this week's Newsweek is basically mission accomplished in Iraq. We've brought democracy there. It may be a bit imperfect, but we've sure made a hell of a start in these first 7 years. And that's basically the gist of the story. It's one of the more repulsive pieces of propaganda I've seen in quite some time, because meanwhile in Iraq, things are not exactly going swimmingly. Of course, all of the coverage on the ground for the average Iraqi has been completely overshadowed by the coverage of the so-called elections, which is basically an election under occupation, where we'll have either U.S.-backed Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and the religiosity that he represents remain in power, who he has basically become a Shia Saddam, or we'll have the other person who's up high as far as the vote counts go, and that's former Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, an admitted CIA asset. So those are the two choices for Iraqis. And meanwhile, the situation on the ground is that we still are looking at now currently 1.3 million dead and counting, upwards of still just about 5 million people displaced, both internally and who have gone abroad, in addition to staggering unemployment rates and an infrastructure that is completely in shambles, despite over $100 billion that was supposedly earmarked for a reconstruction of Iraq. We have it now listed, according to the group Transparency International, as one of the five most corrupt countries on the planet. So, you know, there was supposed to be over $100 billion slated for reconstruction. We still have, two out of three Iraqis don't have access to clean drinking water. The average house in Iraq has maybe 4 or 5 hours of electricity per 24-hour period. And certainly then when we look at, the so-called plans for withdrawal, and I have an article actually that will be coming out on Truthout, this Friday about this very thing to help people get a very clear understanding of U.S. policy in Iraq, because there has, even on the left, it seems like, Dennis, there's been a lot of misunderstanding about, you know, is the U.S. going to withdraw? What's that going to look like? Because, you know, the propaganda, as you said very clearly, the propaganda that we're hearing right now is that, oh, yes, we're going to withdraw. We're getting down to the wire here, and the total withdrawal is certainly going to come at the end of 2011, and this couldn't be further from the truth.
Dar Tamil, you have an amazing quote on your blog, a piece that you're writing about the forgotten war, and you're quoting an Iraqi political analyst, and he's saying, the Western world that slaughtered Iraq and Iraqis through 13 years of sanctions and 7 years of occupation is now turning its back on the victims. What has remained of Iraq is still being devastated by bombings, assassinations, corruption, millions of evictions, and continued infrastructure destruction. Yet the world that caused all this is trying to draw a rosy picture of the situation in Iraq. Well, Dara, that's because they got another war to fight.
Well, sure they do. Of course they do. They've got their hands more than full with Afghanistan, among with the keeping all the hundreds and hundreds of military bases around the globe populated with soldiers. But really, you know, it's just amazing to me that people have really lost sight of what's happening on the ground. And I guess not so amazing when we look at most of the media that people are subjected to that basically just doesn't pay attention to the fact that, for example, right now, according to UNICEF in Iraq, an estimated 2 million children are facing threats on a daily basis of things like lack of adequate nutrition, disease, and an abruptly interrupted education process. 2 million kids in Iraq. So what does this say about the future of that country that the U.S. occupation has caused? It's basically erasing the future for kids in that country. We're looking at nearly a quarter of a million children of primary school age right now are having their education interrupted, mainly because they're displaced, along with because of the security situation. We're looking at other recent studies have shown that just 20% of the people outside of the capital city of Baghdad even have working sewage in their community. We're looking at a massive crisis situation where Iraq is basically a basket case on all fronts. I mean, you know, this is a government that can't even get the garbage collected in Baghdad. It's a crisis situation. People are dying there every day. American soldiers are still being killed there. Yes, the numbers have dropped off, and that's helped the media ignore the situation, but we're still looking at a very violent, volatile, unstable situation there that continues to not get any better with time. And I think if I make one point today, it's just that as we near this 7-year anniversary, while we have a media that's working overtime to try to gloss this situation over and you know, basically run mission accomplished stories on the cover of Newsweek, we have a catastrophe in Iraq, and we need to keep our eyes on the ball and not forget about this, even though the situation in Afghanistan is exploding.
Dar, you write in your book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, that there is really a nightmare, a very troubling situation that has been unfolding in the U.S. military. We've seen the shootouts on bases. We start to see the young vets rocking on the corners of our major cities with no support. Give us a quick assessment of where that story is now.
Well, where that story is, we're looking at resistance increasing and problems in the military increasing. And again, this isn't a surprise when we look at a military that's been way stretched thin for way too long, trying to populate two occupations. For example, most of the people that are being removed from Iraq are basically being given a short break and then sent directly into Afghanistan. I continue to interview soldiers that are telling me stories like, I've already served 2 deployments. I went to my commander. I told him I had PTSD. I did get to go see the doctor, and the doctor gave me meds and then said, pack your bags, you're getting ready to deploy to Iraq. You can get treatment there for your PTSD. We just had a story, McClatchy just released a story today, showing an 11% increase in the military sexual assaults being reported just last year. We're looking at basically an epidemic of sexual assault in the military against both women and men, not just women, but with men too. You know, the statistics we've talked about on that front before, Dennis, that a minimum of 1 in 3 women in the military is going to be sexually assaulted or raped during their contract, according to the VA, in addition to...
1 in 3 women in the military? 1 in 3?
These are the most conservative estimates we have. I think the number is far higher than that, but 1 in 3 women in the military, by the end of their contract, an average contract being 4 years, will be raped or sexually assaulted. That's according to the Veterans Administration. In addition to that, we have another Pentagon report that admits that 80% of all military sexual assaults never even get reported in the first place. So you can do the math with those and see very clearly it's a number much higher than 1 in 3. I've been actually working on a story on this right now and interviewing many, many women, and the situation is continuing. The changes necessary to prevent it from happening are not being made. In addition to escalating rates of post-traumatic stress disorder, people coming back with traumatic brain injury, being redeployed anyway, all the things we've talked about before are worse now than when we talked about them before, and it's exactly because there's not enough troops. They're not getting enough people into the soldiers that are actually being recycled through these occupations. And so, of course, these problems are going to grow worse with time.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, that's the voice of Dar Jamal. Dar, how much are these wars costing now? Do we have any sense of how much money we're spending on war?
Well, they're still roughly the same as they were even 6 months, a year ago, even with this so-called troop drawdown in Iraq. We're still averaging in Iraq alone $720 million a day. So that has actually, it's not surprising to me, it actually hasn't gone down even with them taking the number of troops out. Why has it not gone down? That's because they're still expanding the amount of bases inside of Iraq. We're still looking at, actually, we just, I just came across a story in January where we have a situation with the embassy in Baghdad. It's now been reported, actually, by Robert Ford, who is the deputy chief of mission in Baghdad at that compound, and he told reporters, quote, if Congress gives us the money we are asking for, this embassy is going to be twice the size it is now. It's not going down. It's getting bigger, end quote.
Why do they need such a big embassy, by the way?
It's, yeah, exactly. It's, you know, many people, many analysts are believing that this is basically to become the super base in Iraq, of course, surrounded by at least 4, likely 5 other, they call them, quote, enduring bases, because they won't call them permanent bases. But it's a giant embassy because it's going to basically become a central command for Iraq itself, not for the whole region. That will still be in Doha. But in CENTCOM, this is a giant, it's basically going to be the brain of the occupation. And then the other bases, the 5 enduring bases, they're still expanding runways, they're still upgrading facilities, they're still adding things to these bases, and there's still at least 3 other bases that still have 20,000 plus soldiers in them. And again, like many people I've interviewed for this story that will be coming out on Friday, analysts and other journalists as well, I think all of us would basically have heart failure if at the end of Obama's first term, if there's really less than 50,000 troops. So these deadlines of, well, there's going to be 50,000 troops in Iraq by the end of this August, that may happen. But the second deadline, the end of December 2011, all U.S. troops and contractors are going to be leaving Iraq. Well, the proof is on the ground. If you believe that, it's just simply not going to happen, especially when you look at the National Security Strategy, the Quadrennial Defense Review Report, and really read the fine lines in the Status of Forces Agreement. But even, setting aside this boring documentation for a moment, if you just look at the hard facts on the ground and look at the size of the embassy and the fact that they're about to double the size, both in infrastructure and population of the so-called embassy, and then you look at these other bases, the U.S. didn't pour tens of billions of dollars into constructing these bases that they're augmenting as we speak, to basically hit a point in the occupation where they say, well, looks like things are all good here. Here's the keys, Iraqis. Enjoy the facilities. Enjoy your democracy. We'll see you down the road.
Dar Jamail, what will you be doing on Saturday?
I will be in Washington, D.C. There is a group that's bringing in a memorial out there called the Iraqi Memorial to Life. And it's basically a version of the Arlington West, except a symbolic number of tombstones for the Iraqi people. And so this is going to be set up in the mall. I will be out there sharing some words along with a few other folks involved in that, as well as going out there to give a talk at Busboys and Poets and try to raise some hell. We're also going to be going to a demonstration and rally against John Yoo, who will be gracing Charlottesville. So we'll be there to give him a nice warm welcome.
All right, Dar Jamail, thank you. I thank you for joining us on Flashpoints, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Well, the violence in Honduras continues.
La violencia en Honduras continúa.
And it has continued ever since the coup, which you heard covered on these airwaves almost every day. The situation has led to the death of activists, human rights activists, journalists, student teacher activists, and community organizers. The situation continues to be grave for those who opposed publicly the coup. We have one of those brave souls in our studios with us. We're proud to have with us Padre Andres Tamayo. And he works out. He was born in El Salvador, studied in Honduras, and El Salvador was really a student, if you will, or a sort of inspired by, brought to us through the offices of the late Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was assassinated by right-wing terrorists in El Salvador, who shot him through the voice during a Eucharist for the people. Padre, welcome to Flashpoints.
Bienvenido, padre, a Flashpoints.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, I know that over the last year you were very busy leading resistance, objecting to the coup in Honduras, where you have worked with the poor for many years. Is that violence continuing?
¿Esa violencia continúa?
Continúa mucho porque primero si lo hacemos notar es que doce vidas las desaparecen, los escuadrones de la muerte que siempre están activos en toda Centroamérica, y estos son muertes selectivas, es decir, controlan a los líderes en las marchas y luego después ya los ubican donde viven y después son asesinados. Esa violencia está de ese estilo. Pero hay otra forma de violencia. Por ejemplo, en todas las actividades siempre el ejército sale como a defender el capitalismo. Turns out to defend capitalism. En el caso de la madera, es sacado de, digamos, pero custodiado con militares, con policías, y fuera de eso también lo que es la fiscalía que sale a la defensa. Esa es la violencia, y no solamente eso, sino de la forma como las mismas autoridades siguen, imponiendo sus criterios, sumando como un poder.
Putting their criteria and forcing it. Any form of power abuse.
It's hard to imagine.
Es muy difícil imaginar
that the United States really opposed this coup. They said they opposed the coup. They called for an end of the coup, but they really,
pero en realidad,
the United States did
Estados
not
Unidos
take any action
no
to try and restore democracy, did
para
they?
Restaurar la democracia.
No. Lejos de eso, fueron a destruir la democracia. Ellos presentan la democracia a su manera, a su estilo, bajo sus intereses. Pero para decirle a toda la población, la planificación o los actores intelectuales del golpe de Estado y el mantenimiento también del golpe hasta el día de hoy es con la extrema derecha de los Estados Unidos. Por ejemplo, hay unos involucrados. Uno de ellos es, digamos, Carmona, exilado acá, que dio el golpe de Estado allá en Venezuela. Digamos, hay otro de los Estados Unidos radicado en Miami. Ahorita se me va el nombre de él, pero fueron los que planificaron, los que hacían, recibían, digamos así, las comisiones de Honduras para hacer el lobby y preparar el golpe de Estado en Honduras.
They prepared with counsel and support to
el, digamos, el implicado en esto se llama Otto Rice.
Do you feel that the current president, the current elections that just occurred were fair, and those people who rule the country now are the duly elected candidates of the people?
¿Es la gente fueron elegidos por el pueblo?
No.
Absolutely not.
Eso ya fue un fraude planificado.
Planned out.
Quiero aclarar aquí dos pasos.
Do different parts.
Una de ellas es que, digamos, quién prepara el golpe de Estado en la extrema derecha. Pero la misma comisión, cuando quiere arreglar el problema, comisión diplomática de los Estados Unidos, no es verdad que ellos querían restituir al presidente. Lejos de eso, ellos planificaron de modo tal de llevar al presidente hasta el momento por la cual le diera como espacio o chance a ellos, a la extrema derecha, para montar las elecciones.
They manipulated everything from the extreme right to be able to control the elections.
Al principio, se hablaba sobre la restitución.
They talked about the resistance.
Pero era como para calmar el ánimo de la gente, como para justificar, digamos así, de que estaban haciendo un bien, pero que al final, cuando ellos lograron su objetivo de llevarlo hasta el momento cercano a las elecciones, entonces es allí donde ellos mismos, digamos, su plan se cumplió. Este es uno.
Plan was complete.
Dos,
number two.
Siempre, en este diálogo que hubo, digamos, el gobierno de los Estados Unidos y la extrema derecha de los Estados Unidos, ellos estaban llegando a un negocio, por decir así, y el negocio era, ¿cómo hacemos para que Valenzuela sea el encargado político del hemisferio occidental? ¿Cómo hacemos? Entonces, el gobierno quiere colocar a este personaje. Entonces, hace un negocio con la extrema derecha. Entonces, la extrema derecha le dice, está bien, Valenzuela se va nombrado a este puesto, pero no hables más de elección, no hables más de restitución. Así también Tomás Chano, el embajador que estaba, antes en ese puesto de Valenzuela, para poder concederle, digamos así, la extrema derecha al gobierno y ubicarlo en los Estados Unidos, ese fue el juego que hicieron.
That's the play that they did.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacific Radio, my name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We'll speak with Padre Andres Tamayo. He was a leader in the resistance, in the recent resistance to the coup in Honduras. Just say a little bit about the people who you work with and the kind of needs that they have that really need to be addressed.
Bueno,
Well,
lo que se necesita,
what is needed.
Y yo soy testigo porque estuve caminando con el pueblo, con la organización también de resistencia, hoy llamada Frente Nacional de Resistencia Popular. Lo que sí tira como objetivo, tira como meta, y por eso sigue vivo, sigue fuerte el frente, porque lo que quiere es una refundación de Estado. Ese es lo que quiere el pueblo. Y yo lo digo, ¿por qué el pueblo? Porque el 70% está, digamos, con las acciones del frente, y no solamente está de acuerdo, sino actúa con el frente, está involucrado. Entonces, hasta que no se logre la refundación de Estado, significa la constituyente, cambiar esa constitución y por la cual fue elaborada solamente para defender los intereses capitalistas, empresariales. Entonces, ha visto el pueblo que vale la pena, a pesar de que le hayan torturado, capturado, exilado, que le hayan asesinado a tanta gente, sin embargo, sigue firme en sus ideales, en sus principios, porque lo que quiere es un cambio de país. A eso se le llama refundación de Estado, y no se va a poder dar si no hay una nueva constitución.
Until there's a new constitution, that won't happen.
All right, and let me bring into the conversation now Francisco Dimas. He works with the FMLN. By the way, they won the last election and run El Salvador now, and that's a change from the death squad parties of ARENA. And you are responsible, Francisco, for bringing the Padre here. He's going to be speaking in the Bay Area. Francisco, Padres, Tamayo, we thank both of you for coming in. I want to invite you back, Francisco, to talk a little bit more about what the FMLN is doing and maybe what the relationship may have been between why that coup happened now. Maybe people in this country were nervous that with the FMLN in charge, the United States needed another lackey in the region to implement their policy.
Con mucho gusto voy a estar aquí cuando lo necesiten. Podemos abordar el tema. Voy a hacer un enlace para El Salvador y tener la oportunidad de que la audiencia de GPF conozca información de primera mano con el vocero oficial del FMLN, que manejan ellos los detalles. Pero quiero dar a conocer también de que el 15 de marzo nosotros cumplimos el primer aniversario del triunfo electoral. Triunfo electoral después de casi, exactamente después de 188 años de gobiernos republicanos, derechistas,
elements.
188.
That's a lot of. 188 años de lucha de nuestro pueblo, y en el 2009 pues nosotros llegamos a conquistar el gobierno con el apoyo de nuestro pueblo y la solidaridad internacional.
Muchas gracias.
We thank you. We thank Miguel Gavila Molina for doing the translation. We thank Catherine Austin Fitz for being patient, standing by. Coming up next, community business. Again, thank you. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And we are delighted to welcome back Catherine Austin Fitz, our translator from Wall Street to Main Street, back the other way, and the person who helps us understand what some of this terminology means as it's being done to us. Catherine, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Dennis. What a week.
What a week. Well, I'm noticing that my old friend J.P. Morgan, UBS, Deutsche Bank, they're now charged with fraud, major fraud in Europe. What's that about?
Well, you know, we've talked about the derivatives hooking.
All right, what's a derivative? Tell people again, because nobody remembers.
It's a financial interest and a financial interest. So say I create a company and I have horses and pigs, and I put the horses and pigs in a company and issue stock. That stock is a financial interest in a company that has real things, right? Well, if I issue an option on that stock, then I have a financial interest in a financial interest.
And the option is what? That those animals are going to die, or they're going to make a lot of money for the...
It's an option. Say it's an option to buy the stock. Okay, so it's a financial interest in a financial interest. Most financial interests are financial interest in a real thing. But a derivative is a financial interest in a financial interest.
Okay, and why has that always been such a problem of late?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example. What's been happening with the municipalities is traditionally when a municipality wants to borrow money, they issue bonds. Now, what happened was Wall Street and the banks went to them and said, look, you can save a lot of money by issuing variable rate bonds, and don't worry, we'll protect you because you'll issue a swap, and that swap will protect you if your interest rates go up or down or change, you know, whatever. And the idea was this was all supposed to work. Now, you know, when you have very complicated transactions that municipal and government officials don't really understand, you know what happens. And, of course, it didn't work as intended. And so now the municipalities are liable for fantastic amounts of interest rate payments that they never expected to make. Okay, so everybody's angry. The municipalities don't want to cut basic services so that they can pay the bankers, and they feel like the bankers, you know, cheated them or didn't tell them what was really going on. And I suspect in a lot of these cases, there's, you know, there's some communications and payoffs behind the scenes that, you know, make the thing even look worse. So what you've got is you've got municipalities doing the kind of financings that a municipality should never have done in the first place, and a bunch of banks talking them into doing deals that they should never have done in the first place, and everybody men squabbling. So the details in each are going to be different, but the reality is when you have highly complex financial transactions that people don't really understand, you get messes.
I keep hearing about this very positive thing. People are out buying again. The stock market is looking good. Oh, and yesterday they decided to keep interest rates at sort of zero. What does all that mean?
Well, zero means things aren't so good because they're providing capital. They're basically printing money.
This is the Fed, by the way.
This is the central bank, and it's not just our central bank, but around the world. The central banks are basically expanding the money supply relatively rapidly and creating capital, you know, in a way that expands the money supply. And that's what you do when you're worried about deflation and people not spending. Now, interestingly enough, Dennis, you know, part of the challenge is the money they're creating is only going to certain places. It's not going to the wider group. In fact, what we're seeing is the economy basically shut down and credit cut off from, you know, from small business. So it's almost as though they're trying to get the economy to collapse on Main Street while, you know, pumping up the banks and some of the insiders who've got big financial positions.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Catherine Austin Fitz. Every Wednesday, we invite her on the show to do a segment that we call Community Business. Catherine, today, this is the seventh, well, on Saturday will be the seventh anniversary of the, I'm calling it the illegal war in Iraq. Millions dead, zillions spent, and really no end in sight. And if they ever get out of Iraq, they're going over to Afghanistan, i.e. we're talking about the endless permanent war. In economic terms, why does this keep... Does war keep feeding the economy, and why is it such an easy way to keep certain industries going?
Well, the United States has a position, Dennis, as the reserve currency. Our dollar is the reserve currency of the world, and that comes from certain things. One, having a navy that essentially controls the sea lanes, having with the British and our allies a dominant position in oil, et cetera, et cetera. And if you read Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, which came out sort of in the early part of this decade or last decade, what he basically says is the dynamic economic growth is moving east to Asia, and if we're going to remain dominant, we need to control the Middle East. We need to control Eurasia. And if we don't, the Chinese and Russians will move in. And so you have a competition going. And on one, you know, if you look at the U.S. balance sheet, if it's going to maintain its dominance in oil and commodities and in the dollar, then, you know, there are many strategists who believe we have to be there and dominant. At the same time, there's a huge expense to that. And believe it or not, it's not just the United States that's paying that expense. It's anybody else who has big dollar holdings or positions globally. Because the way we're paying for it is, again, this printing of the money. And the more money you print to pay for it, the more everybody holding dollars is screaming. So it's really people who are being taxed globally through the dollar mechanism.
Why shouldn't people who maybe still have, say, $5,000 or $20,000 left to invest or $100,000, why shouldn't they go running to put their money in Israeli war bonds or in these military contractors that are making the money? Isn't that the way we make money?
Well, but most people are financing that. Most people, if you look at most households in the United States, they have money which is directly or indirectly going into U.S. Treasuries or Fannies or Freddies or other forms of the federal credit. You know, or they're putting money in a bank, and then the bank is buying those securities. So in all of those are essentially war bonds, because half of that money is basically going to finance the military and the management of a global empire. So traditionally in America, the one of the major investments that most Americans make is essentially war bonds. You know, it's always interesting for me to see people who are violently opposed to all of these policies and then look at their financial statements and realize, well, they're financing it.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and this is your daily investigative news magazine. Catherine, the idea, and we've talked about this many times over, if you want to sort of put an end to the peace bridge, what I mean by that is that little bridge between wars where everybody goes and collects the dead and invents new weapons to shoot at each other and to support corporate continuance and domination. I mean, like, how do you shift this?
You have to shift the money. And when you have to have, remember, because the people centralizing the economy are organized globally. So, you know, one of the things that has to happen is the people who'd like to see it all decentralized, which is where we're going to get to peace. And if you want a peace economy, Dennis, it means you have to have an equity-based economy, not a debt-based economy. So we have to finance communities and small business and everybody with equity instead of debt so that your blessing blesses me because I make money in your success.
And so, okay, say something, like, just describe that. What you just said in real terms.
Sure. If you owe me money, then I don't care how you do as long as I get my money. In fact, I can make money sometimes with you failing. I can make more money from your bankruptcy than you're not. Whereas if I have equity in your company or your, you know, it could be a municipal utility or all sorts of things, then I only make money if you succeed. So, for example, in a community, if everybody owned stock in a venture fund or a mutual fund for that community that financed a whole bunch of the little businesses in that community, then the more they shop locally, the more money they'd make. They'd make money on their IRA or 401k because their stock would go up. So an equity model is where we succeed because each other succeeds and we fail because each other fails. So we have a vested interest in helping each other. You know, my whole thing about the popsicle index is, if you're financing a place with equity, then we lose money, you know, from drugs and dysfunction and people failing and not having great education. So it's all about getting our money into alignment with our values, you know, and sort of our vision of the future. And the reality is if you look at how most people in this country make money, most of us make money from doing something that hurts somebody else.
Well, and let me, we got 2 minutes left, and that's exactly what I want to ask you about in 2 minutes. They say this fund that goes to pay for this war in Iraq or Afghanistan, that's a different flow. That doesn't impact on our school budget or on our medical.
That's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard.
But we hear it all the time, right? Go on. I'm sorry.
I mean, that's complete yaya. In other words, the it's one world and it's one balance sheet, one financial statement. Now, yes, we create different pots and different reserves, and we have different things. But the you know, I think what somebody who wanted to argue for the war would say is it's, you know, we have to choose between two options, both of which are ugly. If we don't maintain a dominant position in the Middle East, then the dollar will crash, and the cost is tiny compared to what the cost will be of the Chinese, you know, taking over and getting all the oil they need and completely overwhelming us.
And so how's it going for you there in small town Tennessee? Are you implementing some of these principles?
You know something? I've been trying every day since 1998, and it's a journey, and it's a journey that gets richer the more people who want to do it. And so the more, you know, it's the more people, and I, one of the things that's going to happen this year, of course, is we're headed into the state and local cutbacks, and you'll be gratified to know there have been several articles this week, Dennis, of state and local governments announcing that they're moving money into the small banks. They're changing their banks.
Amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
That's good news.
Yeah, there's you know, a lot of this is going to be a painful process working through the state and local government cutbacks, but people are going to start looking at the money and looking where the money's going and asking a lot of questions. There's going to be a lot of anger and frustration, but ultimately it's the path we need to go through to get to, you know, a better world.
Excellent. Catherine Austin Fitz, solari.com/blog. If you want to communicate with Catherine directly, you can do it that way. We thank you for being with us Wednesday, Catherine, for Community Business. Thank you. And you are listening to Flashpoints. That does wrap it up for another edition.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.